Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Annie Mattson, and tonight we continue Letters of a Woman Homesteader by Eleanor Pruitt Stewart, read by Mary Jo Rudolph. We last left Eleanor at a sewing bee with friends and neighbors coming together to help Cora Bell, a young girl in desperate need of some new clothes.
Late in the afternoon of the 29th, a funny something showed up. Fancy a squeaky, rickety old wagon without a vestige of paint. The tires had come off and had been set at home. That is done by heating the tires red hot and having the rims of the wheels covered with several layers of burlap or other old rags, well wet. Then the red hot tire is put on and water hurriedly poured on to shrink the iron and to keep the burlap from blazing. Well, whoever had set Cora Bell's tires had forgotten to cut away the surplus burlap, so all the ragtags were merrily waving in the breeze. Cora Bell's team would bring a smile to the soberest face alive. Sheba is a tall, lanky old mare. Once she was bay in color, but the years have added gray hair until now she is roan. Being so long-legged, she strides along at an amazing pace, which her mate, Balaam, a little donkey, finds it hard to keep up with. Balaam, like Sheba, is full of years. Once his glossy brown coat was the pride of some Mexican's heart, but time has added to his color also, and now he is blue. His eyes are sunken and dim. His ears no longer stand up in true donkey style, but droop dejectedly. He has to trot his best to keep up with Sheba's slowest stride. About every 3 miles he balks, but little Cora Bell doesn't call it balking. She says Balaam has stopped to rest, and they sit and wait till he is ready to trot along again. That is the kind of layout which drew up before our door that evening. Cora Bell was driving, and she wore her wonderful pink dress, which hung down in a peak behind, fully 6 inches longer than anywhere else. The poor child had no shoes. The winter had tried the last pair to their utmost endurance, and the rheumatiz had long since got the last dollar, so she came with her chubby little sunburned legs bare. Her poor little scarred feet were clean, her toenails full of nicks almost into the quick, broken against rocks when she had been herding her sheep. In the back of the wagon, flat on the bottom, sat Grandma and Grandpa, such bundles of coats and blankets I can't describe. After a great deal of trouble, we got them unloaded and into the house. Then Mrs. Louderer entertained them while Mrs. O'Shaughnessy and I prepared supper and got a bath ready for Cora Bell. We had a T-bone steak, mashed potatoes, hominy, hot biscuits and butter, and stewed prunes. Their long ride had made them hungry, and I know they enjoyed their meal. After supper, Cora Bell and I washed the dishes while Mrs. O'Shaughnessy laid out the little clothes. Cora Bell's clothes were to be a surprise. The postmistress here also keeps a small store and has ribbon, and when she heard of our plans for Mr. Stewart, she sent up a couple of pairs of hair ribbon for Cora Bell. Soon Mrs. O'Shaughnessy called us, and Cora Bell and I went into the bedroom where she was. I wish you could have seen that child. Poor little neglected thing. She began to cry. She said, "They ain't for me. I know they ain't. Why, it ain't my birthday. It's Granny's." Nevertheless, she had her arms full of them and was clutching them so tightly with her work-worn little hands that we couldn't get them. She sobbed so deeply that Grandma heard her and became alarmed. She hobbled to the door and pounded with her poor twisted hands, calling all the while, "Cory, Cory Bell, what ails you?" She got so excited that I opened the door, but Cora Bell told her to go away. She said, "They ain't for you, Granny. They ain't for me either." People here observe Decoration Day faithfully, and Cora Bell had brought half a wagon load of iris, which grows wild here. Next morning we were all up early, but Cora Bell's flowers had wilted, and she had to gather more, but we all hurried and helped. She said as she was going to see her mother, she wanted to wear her prettiest dress. so Gail and Mrs. O'Shaughnessy helped her to get ready. The cemetery is only about 2 miles away, so we were all down quite early. We were obliged to hurry because others were coming to help sew. Cora Bell went at once to the graves where her parents lie side by side and began talking to her mother just as though she saw her. "You didn't know me, did you, Mother, with my pretty new things? But I am your little girl, Mama. I am your little Cora Bell." After she had talked and had turned every way like a proud little bird, she went to work. And oh, how fast she worked! Both graves were first completely covered with pine boughs. It looked like sod, so closely were the little twigs laid. Next she broke the stems off the iris and scattered the blossoms over, and the effect was very beautiful. Then we hurried home and everybody got busy. The men took Grandpa off to another part of the ranch where they were fanning oats to plant and kept him all day. That was good for him because then he could be with the men all day, and he so seldom has a chance to be with men. Several ladies came, and they all made themselves at home and worked like beavers, and we all had a fine time. Sedalia was present and almost caused a riot. She says she likes unusual words because they lend distinction to conversation. Well, they do, sometimes. There was another lady present whose children are very gifted musically, but who have the bad name of taking what they want without asking. The mother can neither read nor write, and she is very sensitive about the bad name her children have. While we were all busy, someone made a remark about how smart these children were. Sedalia thought that a good time to get in a big word, so she said, "Yes, I have always said Lula was a progeny." Mrs. Hall didn't know what she meant and thought that she was casting reflections on her child's honesty. So with her face scarlet and her eyes blazing, she said, "Sedalia Lane, I won't allow you nor nobody else to say my child is a progeny. You can take that back or I will slap you peaked." Sedalia took it back in a hurry. So I guess little Lula Hall is not a progeny. Everyone left about 4 except Gail, Mrs. O'Shaughnessy, Mrs. Louderer, and the Edmondsons. They had farthest to go, so they stayed overnight again. We worked until 10 o'clock that night over Grandma's clothes, but everything was thoroughly finished. Every button was on, every thread end knotted and clipped, and some tired workers lay down to rest, as did a very happy child and a very thankful old lady. Everyone got away by 10 o'clock the next morning. The last I saw of little Cora Bell was when they had reached the top of a long slope and Balaam had stopped to rest. The breeze from the south was playfully fluttering the rags on the wheels. Presently I heard a long hee-haw, hee-haw, and I knew Balaam had rested and had started. I have been a very busy woman since I began this letter to you several days ago. A dear little child has joined the angels. I dressed him and helped to make his casket. There is no minister in this whole country, and I could not bear the little broken lily bud to be just carted away and buried, so I arranged the funeral and conducted the services. I know I am unworthy and in no way fitted for such a mission, but I did my poor best, and if no one else is comforted, I am. I know the message of God's love and care has been told once anyway, to people who have learned to believe more strongly in hell than in heaven. Dear friend, I do hope that this new year will bring you and yours fuller joys than you have ever known. If I had all the good gifts in my hands, you should certainly be blessed. Your sincere friend, Eleanor Rupert Stewart. 11. Zebby's Story, September 1st, 1910. Dear Mrs. Coney, it was just a few days after the birthday party and Mrs. O'Shaughnessy was with me again. We were down at the barn looking at some new pigs when we heard the big corral gates swing shut, so we hastened out to see who it could be so late in the day. It was Zebby. He had come on the stage to Burnt Fork, and the driver had brought him on here. There was so much to tell, and he whispered he had something to tell me privately, but that he was too tired then. So after supper, I hustled him off to bed. Next morning, the men went off to their work, and Zebby and I were left to tell secrets. When he was sure we were alone, he took from his trunk a long, flat box. Inside was the most wonderful shirt I have ever seen. It looked like a cross between a nightshirt and a shirt waist. It was of homespun linen. The bosom was ruffled and tucked, all done by hand. Such tiny stitches, such patience and skill. Then he handed me an old daguerreotype. I unfastened the little golden hook, and inside was a face good to see and to remember. It was dim, yet clear in outline, just as if she were looking out from the mellow twilight of long ago. The sweet, elusive smile, I couldn't tell where it was, whether it was the mouth or the beautiful eyes that were smiling. All that was visible of her dress was the Dutch collar, just like what is being worn now. It was pinned with an ugly old brooch which Zebby said was a breast pin he had given her. Under the glass on the other side was a strand of faded hair and a slip of paper. The writing on the paper was so faded it was scarcely readable, but it said, Pauline Gorley, age 22, 1860. Next he showed me a note written by Pauline, simply worded, but it held a world of meaning for Zebby. It said, I spun and wove this cloth at Adeline's, enough for me a dress and you a shirt, which I made. It is for the wedding, else to be buried in. Yours, Pauline. The shirt, the picture, and the note had waited for him all these years in Mothy's care. And now I will tell you the story. Long, long ago, someone did something to someone else and started a feud. Unfortunately, the Gorleys were on one side and the Parkers on the other. That it all happened before either Zebby or Pauline was born made no difference. A Gorley must hate a Parker always, as also a Parker must hate a Gorley. Pauline was the only girl, and she had a regiment of big brothers who gloried in the warfare and wanted only the slightest pretext to shoot a Parker. So they grew up, and Zebby often met Pauline at the quiltings and other gatherings at the homes of nonpartisans. He remembers her so perfectly and describes her so plainly that I can picture her easily. She had brown eyes and hair. She used to ride about on her sorrel palfrey with her neighbor boy Caesar on behind to open and shut plantation gates. She wore a pink calico sunbonnet, and Zebby says she was just like the pink hollyhocks that grew by Mother's window. Isn't that a sweet picture? Her mother and father were both dead, and she and her brothers lived on their plantation. Zebby had never dared speak to her until one day he had driven over with his mother and sisters to a dinner given on a neighboring plantation. He was standing outside near the wall when someone dropped a spray of apple blossoms down upon him from an upper window. He looked up, and Pauline was leaning out, smiling at him. After that, he made it a point to frequent places where he might expect her. And things went so well that presently Caesar was left at home, lest he should tell the brothers. She was a loyal little soul, and would not desert, although he urged her to, even promising to go away, plumb away, clean to Scott County, if she would go. She told him that her brothers would go even as far as that to kill him, so that they must wait and hope. Finally, Zebby got tired of waiting, and one day he boldly rode up to the Gorley home and formally asked for Pauline's hand. The bullet he got for his presumption kept him from going to the war with his father and brother when they marched away. Sometime later, George Gorley was shot and killed from ambush, and although Zebby had not yet left his bed, the Gorleys believed he did it, And one night, Pauline came through a heavy rainstorm with only Caesar to warn Zebby and to beg him for her sake to get away as fast as he could that night. She pleaded that she could not live if he were killed and could never marry him if he killed her brothers. So she persuaded him to go while they were all innocent. Well, he did as she wished, and they never saw each other again. He never went home again until last Thanksgiving, and dear little Pauline had been dead for years. She herself had taken her little gifts for Zebby to Mothy to keep for him. Some years later, she died and was buried in the dress she mentioned. It was woven at Adeline Carter's, one of the bitterest enemies of the Gorleys. But the sacrifice of her pride did her no good because she was long at rest before Zebby knew. He had been greatly grieved because no stone marked her grave, only a tangle of rosebriars. So he bought a stone, and in the night before Decoration Day, he and two of Uncle Buck's grandsons went to the Gorley burying ground and raised it to the memory of sweet Pauline. Some of the Gorleys still live there, so he came home at once, fearing if they should find out who placed the stone above their sister, they would take vengeance on his poor, frail body. After he had finished telling me his story, I felt just as I used to when Grandmother opened the big chist to air her wedding clothes and the dress each of her babies wore when baptized. It seemed almost like smelling the lavender and rose leaves, and it was with reverent fingers that I folded the shirt, the work of love, yellow with age, and laid it in the box. Well, Mrs. O'Shaughnessy returned, and early one morning we started with a wagon and a bulging mess box for Zebby's home. We were going a new and longer route in order to take the wagon. Dandelions spread a carpet of gold. Larkspur grew waist high with its long spikes of blue. The service bushes and the wild cherries were a mass of white beauty. Meadowlarks and robins and bluebirds twittered and sang from every branch, it almost seemed. A sky of tenderest blue bent over us, and fleecy little clouds drifted lazily across. Soon we came to the pineries, where we traveled up deep gorges and canyons. The sun shot arrows of gold through the pines down upon us, and we gathered our arms full of columbines. The little black squirrels barked and chattered saucily as we passed along, and we were all children together. We forgot all about feuds and partings, death and hard times. All we remembered was that God is good and the world is wide and beautiful. We plodded along all day. Next morning there was a blue haze that Zebby said meant there would be a high wind, so we hurried to reach his home that evening. The sun was hanging like a great red ball in the smoky haze when we entered the long canyon in which is Zebby's cabin. Already it was dusky in the canyons below, but not a breath of air stirred. A more delighted man than Zebby I never saw when we finally drove up to his low, comfortable cabin. Smoke was slowly rising from the chimney, and Gavotte, the man in charge, rushed out, and the hounds set up a joyful barking. Gavotte is a Frenchman, and he was all smiles and gesticulations as he said, "Welcome, welcome! Today I am rejoiced you have come. Yesterday I am despair if you have come because I am scrub, but today, behold, I am delight." I have heard of clean people, but Gavotte is the cleanest man I ever saw. The cabin floor was so white I hated to step upon it. The windows shone, and at each there was a calico curtain, blue and white check, unironed but newly washed. In one window was an old brown pitcher, cracked and nicked, filled with thistles. I never thought them pretty before, but the pearly pink and the silvery green were so pretty and looked so clean that they had a new beauty. Above the fireplace was a great black eagle which Gavotte had killed, the wings outspread and a bunch of arrows in the claws. In one corner near the fire was a washstand, and behind it hung the fishing tackle. Above one door was a gun rack, on which lay the rifle and shotgun, and over the other door was a pair of deer antlers. In the center of the room stood the square homemade table, every inch scrubbed. In the side room, which is the bedroom, was a wide bunk made of pine plank that had also been scrubbed, then filled with fresh, sweet boughs, and over them was spread a piece of canvas that had once been a wagon sheet, but Gavotte had washed it and boiled and pounded it until it was clean and sweet. That served for a sheet. Zebby was beside himself with joy. The hounds sprang upon him and expressed their joy unmistakably. He went at once to the corrals to see the critters, and every one of them was safely penned for the night. Old Syme, an old ram, goodness knows how old, promptly butted him over, but he just beamed with pleasure. "Syme knows me, dinged if he don't," was his happy exclamation. We went into the cabin and left him fondling the critters. Gavotte did himself proud getting supper. We had trout and the most delicious biscuit. Each of us had a crisp, tender head of lettuce with a spoonful of potato salad in the center. We had preserves made from canned peaches and the firmest yellow butter. Soon it was quite dark, and we had a tiny brass lamp which gave but a feeble light, but it was quite cool, so we had a blazing fire which made it light enough. When supper was over, Zebby called us out and asked us if we could hear anything. We could hear the most peculiar, long-drawn, sighing wail that steadily grew louder and nearer. I was really frightened, but he said it was the forerunner of the windstorm that would soon strike us. He said it was wind coming down Crag Canyon, and in just a few minutes it struck us like a cold wave and rushed, sighing, on down the canyon. We could hear it after it had passed us, and it was perfectly still around the cabin. Soon we heard the deep roaring of the coming storm, and Zebby called the hounds in and secured the door. The sparks began to fly up the chimney. Jerrine lay on a bearskin before the fire, and Mrs. O'Shaughnessy and I sat on the old blue settle at one side. Gavotte lay on the other side of the fire on the floor, his hands under his head. Zebby got out his beloved old fiddle, tuned up, and began playing. Outside, the storm was raging, growing worse all the time. Zebby played and played. The worse the tumult, the harder the storm, the harder he played. I remember I was holding my breath, expecting the house to be blown away every moment, and Zebby was playing what he called Bonaparte's Retreat. It all seemed to flash before me. I could see those poor, suffering soldiers staggering along in the snow. Sacrifices to one man's unholy ambition. I verily believe we were all bewitched. I shouldn't have been surprised to have seen witches and gnomes come tumbling down the chimney, or flying in at the door, riding on the crest of the storm. I glanced at Mrs. O'Shaughnessy. She sat with her chin in her hand, gazing with unseeing eyes into the fire. Zebby seemed possessed. He couldn't tire. It seemed like hours had passed and the tumult had not diminished. I felt like shrieking, but I gathered Jerrine up into my arms and carried her into bed. Mrs. O'Shaughnessy came with us. She touched my elbow and said, "Child, don't look toward the window. The banshees are out tonight." We knelt together beside the bed and said our beads. Then, without undressing save pulling off our shoes, we crawled under our blankets and lay on the sweet, clean pine. We were both perfectly worn out, but we could not sleep. There seemed to be hundreds of different noises of the storm, for there are so many canyons, so many crooks and turns, and the great forest, too. The wind was shrieking, howling, and roaring all at once. A deep boom announced the fall of some giant of the forest. I finally dozed off even in that terrible din, but Zebby was not so frenzied as he had been. He was playing Annie Laurie, and that song has always been a favorite of mine. The storm began gradually to die away, and Annie Laurie sounded so beautiful. I was thinking of Pauline, and I know to Zebby Annie Laurie and Pauline Gorley are one and the same. I knew no more until I heard Zebby call out, "Ho, you sleepy heads, it's day." Mrs. O'Shaughnessy turned over and said she was still sleepy. My former visit had taught me what beauty the early morning would spread before me. so I dressed hastily and went outdoors. Zebby called me to go for a little walk. The amber light of the new day was chasing the violet and amethyst shadows down the canyons. It was all more beautiful than I can tell you. On one side, the canyon walls were almost straight up. It looked as if we might step off into a very world of mountains. Soon old Baldy wore a crown of gleaming gold. The sun was up. We walked on and soon came to a brook. We were washing our faces in its icy waters when we heard twigs breaking, so we stood perfectly still. From out the undergrowth of birch and willows came a deer with two fawns. They stopped to drink and nibbled the bushes, but soon they scented strangers, and looking about with their beautiful, startled eyes, they saw us, and away they went like the wind. We saw many great trees uptorn by the storm. High up on the cliffs, Zebby showed me where the eagles built every year. We turned homeward and sat down upon the trunk of a fallen pine to rest and take another look at the magnificent view. Zebby was silent, but presently he threw a handful of pebbles down the canyon wall. I am not sorry Pauline is dead. I have never shed a tear. I know you think that is odd, but I have never wanted to mourn. I am glad that it is as it is. I am happy and at peace because I know she is mine. The little breeze is Pauline's own voice. She had a little caressing way, just like the gentlest breeze when it stirs your hair. There is something in everything that brings back Pauline. The beauty of the morning, the song of a bird, or the flash of its wings. The flowers look like she did. So I have not lost her. She is mine more than ever. I have always felt so, but was never quite sure until I went back and saw where they laid her. I know people think I am crazy, but I don't care for that. I shall not hate to die. When you get to be as old as I am, child, everything will have a new meaning to you. At last we slowly walked back to the cabin, and at breakfast, Zebby told of the damage the storm had done. He was so commonplace that no one would ever have guessed his strange fancy. I shall never forget Zebby as I last saw him. It was the morning we started home. After we left the bench that Zebby lives on, our road wound down into a deeper canyon. Zebby had followed us to where a turn in the canyon should hide us from view. I looked back and saw him standing on the cliffs, high above us, the early morning sun turning his snowy hair to gold, the breeze fingers of Pauline tossing the scanty locks. I shall always remember him so, a living monument to a dead past. Eleanor Stewart.
Thank you for listening to The Bookshelf. I'm Annie Mattson, and this has been Letters of a Woman Homesteader by Eleanor Pruitt Stewart, read by Mary Jo Rudolph.